Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I wonder if the other kids graduating with Angela Johnson back in the late 70s ever imagined she would go on to write some of the best kids' books in America. After all, that senior class of Wyndham High in that year voted Angela Johnson as the one with the worst temper. I wonder what they're thinking now. Angela Johnson was just named one of this year's MacArthur Fellows, a recipient of the coveted Genius Grant. Now, something, somewhere, happened to all that teenage anger, and Johnson has a stack of books to show for it. There are picture books for toddlers about trains and about work, also about the strange behavior of grown-ups and getting old. There are also books for teenagers about difficult subjects like pregnancy and adoption. Connection listeners, normally when we say a storybook ending, we're talking about Happily Ever After. But is there room in Happily Ever After for setbacks and grief, loss, and emotional hardship? Are you prepared to read your child a story that tackles questions about divorce or death? Or should children's literature let some of the harsher realities of life play out off the page and offer kids an escape that doesn't necessarily remind them of home? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today from a studio at WKSU in Kent, Ohio, is the writer Angela Johnson. Congratulations on your award.
Thank you so much.
I gather you heard about this with a message on your answering machine. Is that right? What did they say?
Well, I have to start by saying that I got home from the post office and saw on my caller ID John D. and Catherine T. I thought they were fundraising. It was amazing. I didn't know that they did that. And there was this wonderful message from Daniel Socolo, who obviously had been handed some very heinous information about me, that I didn't return phone messages. Don't know who could have told him that. But he asked me two or three times that to please call him back, and that it was very important and it would be worth my wilds.
Still sounds like a pitch, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was a pitch. I got a little nervous. Yeah. And after calling twice, calling the wrong number, I finally got him. So that was fun.
Well, I think that it's great news for you and great news for children's literature. I wanted to ask you, If I can start talking about what it is you do, Angela, about a book that you wrote some time ago. I think The Ant in Our House was written back in the mid-90s. Is that right?
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about it because in many ways it kind of speaks to me of exactly what it is you do. And for anyone who hasn't read it, it's a story about two kids and an aunt comes to visit, mm-hmm. right? Stop me if I'm getting this wrong, Angela.
No, you're right on.
And it happens also to be a beautifully illustrated book by David Soman. But
indeed,
there's a part in the book where the kids are sitting on the floor and looking at the ant who's looking out the window, and the little bit of your text says, "But sometimes the ant in our house is quiet and looks out the window all day." And Connection listeners, that's it. That's all you get. That's the only hint. There's no sort of last page thing about the aunt as, you know, having had her house burned down or a family breakup. None of that, Angela, is ever explained in the book. Why is that?
You know, when I first wrote the book, I thought maybe it was a bit sad. But, you know, I started to change my mind about it and I thought, you know, this is life. You know, small children, they see adults, and they see adults in a certain context. And sometimes the adult sadness isn't something that they can understand, but it's there. And, you know, I thought it was something very important, you know, to write about because, you know, in most picture books, you know, you want to see the happy story. You want to see everything working out in the end. But sometimes adults are unhappy people, and they love you anyway, but you can't make them happier, and maybe at some points in their life they can't be happy. So I thought that was important. I thought that was important to write about.
And important not to teach kids that there is a storybook answer to every question?
Oh, truly. Not everything comes out roses and puppies.
It doesn't?
It's amazing, isn't it? But I mean, actually, you know, I'm a very happy person. I came from an extremely warm and wonderful family, which I find really interesting because I've been told I have sort of a bleak view. But I think I have a realistic view. I think children are stronger than than we take them for. I actually believe that sometimes they look at us and just shake their heads and go, wow, you know, why aren't these people being real with me?
Let me ask you something, Angela. When you're doing something like a picture book and aiming it for kids who might be 3, 4, 5 years old, do you see and conceive that book as a 4 or 5 year old Angela Johnson, or do you have a little focus group of nieces and nephews you run that by? How do you do it?
Actually, most of the picture books I write is poetry. I'd like to say that I can get into the head of a 3-year-old or remember when, but you know, it was so long ago. I think surrounding myself with children, which I do a lot, is very helpful in helping me sort of glimpse the world of children. It's quite amazing. They live in this incredible world of fantasy that, you know, at the drop of a hat, they can walk away from and, you know, live in the world of people telling them what to do. And I really just try to get a glimpse of that, you know, because with me, just a glimpse is amazing.
So back to the aunt in our house. The kids that we meet in the book have a mother and a father who are mixed race. It's not something that you ever comment on in the book. It's just there. And it's the explanation of whatever it is that's plaguing the aunt is never given to us. And the point of that is to what, Angela? To say that this is just part of life?
That's true. That's exactly what I wanted to say. I believe that I write universal stories if the characters are African-American, you know, Caucasian, Asian, whatever. They're all universal stories. And I like to get that across. I mean, because sometimes the writing is judged, you know, ethnically, culturally, and it really, with me, has never made any difference because everything I write about, I believe, is universal. It's every man, every woman, every child's story. I hope so.
Now, some of the books that one of the most recent of yours are now books for young adults. Is that's just teenagers, right?
Yeah, that's teens.
Okay.
Uh-huh. For young adults.
This is called The First Part Last, and it's a story that it comes from an experience that you had in New York. Is that right?
Actually, I was in New York with the oh, goodness, it's on the tip of my tongue who I was there. I was doing sort of after-school programs for the National Book Award people, and it was a wonderful experience there for a week. I was on a subway. The children hadn't come home from school for the program yet, so I was just sort of riding the subways and enjoying, and I was sitting on the subway, and a young man, probably maybe 15 or 16, was holding a baby. And it struck me, you know, okay, this is the time of day when maybe his high school is out or, you know, maybe he's taking this little girl, his sister, to a doctor or whatever. And it came to me that this baby he was holding could very well have been his child, you know. And I mean, I looked at him and he is a child.
Yeah.
And I was just blown over. I mean, just shocked that at 15, you know, my mother was telling me to close the door and not let the heat out of the house. And the idea of, you know, raising a child, it overcame me. And he was so gentle and so loving with her that he got off the subway and I almost followed him. But I thought, yeah, you're a great, strange stalking woman, you know, following this young man. But it really was an impetus for me to start writing The First Part Last.
And there's a lot of crying in the book. There is dying in the book. There's shouting in the book. But it's not just that. You also use a lot of tenderness there. You just talked about the way that you saw that young man with the baby, and that's that's the way that you draw the character Bobby and the baby Feather as well.
Yes, because all those other things are very valid. You have a 16-year-old who is a father. This is never good. No family can be happy that a child that they thought had so much promise should go on and lead a full life all of a sudden is burdened with a child. I mean, this is not happy families. This is not a wonderful story about the grandparents being all they could be because, you know, they did not want this. But decisions were made and the young man decides to be a man. And, you know, there's the gentle part. He loves his daughter. It's not easy, you know. It's not everyone throwing themselves at his feet wanting to help him. It's like life. It's messy, and some parts of it are loving, and other parts are ugly. And I believe that's as it is.
So, when you write the books, Angela, are you thinking to yourself, this can be useful to kids who may be going through this, or are you thinking more that these are stories that just aren't being told?
You know, I don't know that they're actually, they are being told. There's this wonderful book called Hanging On to Max. They are being told, but I truly believe that you change minds by not preaching. You know, that if something just is, this is a piece of literature, it was written, it was one person's story. Another 16-year-old boy with a baby, it's a different story. The idea that I'm even discussing the idea that a young man in would be raising his daughter in some circles is a little bit subversive. You know, the idea that everyone didn't come forward and save him, you know, that their other grandparents didn't save him. So I think the story stands on its own, and I actually hope someone takes something away from it, i.e. this isn't pretty. I don't think I romanticized it. And I guess it is a lesson, although I don't set out to write lessons. Cautionary tale, maybe?
Were some of these subjects, the subjects like divorce and mental illness and other subjects that you will weave into your stories, are these things that in your own mind weren't well explained to you as a kid, and you're thinking, you know, I'm going to make sure that they're out there on the tabletop for other kids?
Well, you know, interesting enough, I believe that I'm so open about these things because they were explained and they were never demonized when I was a child. Parents have always been very open with me. There were very few taboos when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that people would keep secrets and not talk about mentally ill relatives and, you know, not talk about teenage pregnancy, I mean, that was in my face. My parents were very open. And I think they allowed me to write about things that, you know, they're universal themes that seem to be pretty hidden in, you know, in some families, in a lot of families. So I was actually given the freedom to write these things.
I bet you get people coming up to you now telling you stories that they would like to see in books.
Oh, it's incredible. It's absolutely, as a matter of fact, the book about schizophrenia, I mentioned once to a friend of mine that I was thinking of writing a book. All of a sudden, she must have talked to someone. I started getting all these phone calls. And people were sharing stories with me about their siblings who were ill, who had schizophrenia. And it was amazing. And people who'd never talked about this, all of a sudden, you know, this was no longer a secret. This was no longer, you know, something they were ashamed of. Someone was going to talk about it. So I was very excited. And, man, I can't say enough for the human spirit that ultimately we do evolve. We really do evolve.
What's the title of the book about schizophrenia?
Humming Whispers.
Humming Whispers. Okay.
Yes.
I remembered Nika, the girl, but I couldn't think of the title. Connection listeners, mm-hmm. My guest is Angela Johnson. She is one of this year's recipients of the MacArthur Genius Grant. We're talking about her work as a children's writer, not just picture books, but also books for teenagers and some of the delicate subjects that she chooses to put up front in the book, whether or not you think those are the things that kids specifically should be reading about, or whether or not some of it should be left out of literature. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, my guest is Angela Johnson, children's book author, recently named winner of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. Among her recent books, I Dream of Trains, a picture book set in the turn of the 20th century Mississippi Delta, A Cool Moonlight, that's one for grade schoolers, about a little girl, Lila, who can't go out in the daylight because she has that disease which I can barely pronounce, xeroderma pigmentosum. Is that right, Angela?
Exoderma pigmentosum.
Thank you. Ooh. And the first part last. We just spoke about that. That's the teenage novel about Bobby, who learns that his girlfriend is pregnant and finds out that he's going to be a very young father. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Stowe, Massachusetts, and Dave's with us now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dick. Hi, Angela. Great show.
Thank you.
I wanted to just make a comment about the premise of children being able to handle, you know, difficult things. it seems pretty clear to me that children can handle a lot more than adults can handle in general, and they will feed off of the fears of adults. So if the adult is okay with something, the child is, oh, okay, this is a difficult situation, but I'll deal with it. And the Angela, you were just talking about before the break, confirming this idea that children, you were exposed to a lot of things. Your parents were open about things, and I think we could do our children so much good if we expose them to more stuff and just let them know, hey, I'm not comfortable with this, but here it is.
I agree.
I wonder, Dave, though, whether or not the book that might, deal with the way a young kid faces schizophrenia or divorce is exactly as you and Angela say, something that the kids are totally able to handle. But maybe the mother or the father or the aunt or the uncle that buys the book sort of goes, oh, no, I think I want something that's happier.
Yeah. That becomes a problem. Adults, as a rule, we want to protect our children. We want to shelter them from what we think are outside forces that may, frighten them or, not help them become, the full-fledged, loving, caring people that we want them to go out there and be. But ultimately, when you protect children from this, you end up, at 18, they're out of your home and they're clueless. And everything is amazing to them. And, I think we have to build that sensitivity when they're young and let them know, the world, it's again, not puppies and roses, but it is a wonderful place and bad things do happen.
Right. But you want these to be stories that kids read rather than something that's put under a library title of self-help or, dealing
exactly.
with loss, right?
Exactly. You want that out there. And, I've talked to many, parents who will say, I hesitated getting your book, but, when I brought it home, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And my daughter and I discussed it, my son and I discussed it. And something that I was really having a problem with, it turned out it was not such a big deal to them. Again, I don't think we give our children enough credit. They live on this. They live in this planet. They can't be. They have to be affected by everything that goes on. I mean, these kids see the news, but when you have a loving, caring adult taking them through something that's tragic, this is only a good thing. There's nothing to be said for information that's given lovingly and kindly and without all of the reservations of thinking that. They can't handle it. And you're right. I think the caller said it's what he said about the adults having the problems because we build up all through the ages all these walls. And it's more complicated with us. With kids, it's not as complicated.
Let me ask you something else, though, Angela, because a number of the covers of your book have the faces of African-American kids on them. And so when we talk mm-hmm. about where people place the books, do you find, mm-hmm. for example, that as a children's writer? Now, you've, twice won the Coretta Scott King Award for your writing. But does it mean also that when someone's figuring out where on the bookstore shelf to put your book or in the library, it's like, oh, well, this goes for black readers over here.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. There is that problem. I'm an African-American woman, and that's who I am. My stories are universal, but, we don't live in a perfect world. It's far from it. And people, it's easier for people who truly don't understand the culture of books, even that they can, it's easier for them to pigeonhole something. They say, aha, black cover, we'll put this over here, which means that some of these books do not get widely read because it's just easier if, we just put them in this little section and we don't stretch. They don't read the books or understand that the stories are universal. That is a big problem, and it always has been.
You met someone at a bookseller's conference who kind mm-hmm. of set you off on that. Tell me that story.
Unfortunately, very kind woman, but, I wanted to scream, and I don't do that anymore. I managed to hold in a lot better than I used to. She was saying that she thought that my young adult novels were appropriate for all teenagers, because they were a certain age. And she realized that even, teenagers from the suburbs could really get something out of my books. But she believed that the younger children who lived in the suburbs or in a rural setting, really, it probably wasn't a good idea for some of my books to be read to them because, you know, they really didn't understand the urban settings and maybe that was just going to be a little bit too much for them. Well, you know.
These aren't urban books.
These are not urban books. Well, you know, my head wanted to fall off and I wanted to start screaming, but I was in a public place and there were a few thousand people around and that would have looked really ugly, you know, in the next conference I went to. And, you know, and I gently said, well, you know, I think if you give it a chance, you'll see that, you know, even if these were urban settings, what are we trying to keep these children from? Are we saying they're going to grow up and never live in an urban setting, never know anyone in an urban setting? Or a catchphrase might have been African-American setting, which, of course, was very...
You mean the code urban
the
meant
code urban
African-American.
Meant African-American, which basically I think that's it. You know, considering some of these books, you know, are definitely in the country with tractors and cows. So that was a little upsetting.
I wonder if the whole award system isn't in some way a part of that. I mean, if Angela Johnson is winning Coretta Scott King Awards, then we don't need to consider her for a Newbery or a Caldecott. I mean, I don't know how far you go with this.
Well, it's been talked about and and every year we go all around and through it. In the last few years, there have been African-American winners of the Newbery. Newbery honors Virginia Hamilton, Paul Curtis, wonderful writers both. But when you look on the big wide scale of things, we're underrepresented. And, you know, I mean, this is always something. The idea of the Coretta Scott King Award obviously is a wonderful thing because – you know, if not for it, some of us would never have been recognized, and it's unfortunate. And I don't want to generalize, you know, the committees because some of them are incredible. And, you know, and I don't want to minimize the books that win because, wow, you know, I'm blown away every year and they really get it. But I do believe this is a problem. I mean, human, I think it's collective. It's a sort of a collective, you know, prejudice. And I don't think sometimes it's vicious, but I do believe it's collective.
No, it's just a sort of benign. There's this bookshelf here and there's that bookshelf
exactly.
there. Right?
You know, and hey, they've got their award and oh, hey, she's been represented. But, you know, it doesn't work the same. You know, they will put every Newbery Award winning book, you know, in Borders or Barnes & Noble. But that's not necessarily so for Coretta Scott King Awards.
All right. Let's talk more about the kids in your books. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Durham, North Carolina now. Frank's joining us. Hi, Frank.
Good morning. Geez, you just brought up a second subject.
I know. Isn't that dirty?
Yeah, it is. I would like to comment that my wife is a children's librarian who got her library degree in a historically black university. And everything that was just said is certainly believed by African American and other minority librarians regarding the Newbery and the Coretta Scott King. But what I originally called for was to possibly suggest a reason that children can handle issues and problems that we as adults have trouble seeing. Children grow up in a world of giants, monsters, literally. Furniture is too big. The people are huge. Absolutely everything that they see is gigantic. When you live in a world of giants, fantasy is reality or close to it, and reality isn't that far from fantasy.
So what happens then, Frank, when you pull kids into the reality that is the giant's world and say, guess what? Guess why your father's sister is now living with us, or guess why Granny's in the hospital now?
I would suggest that maybe the right response to that is, well, that's the way it is. And if I have to live in a place that doesn't fit me in any possible way, or at least not too many ways, I just have to accept what's there.
And, I agree.
You know, I do accept what's there, and I live with it.
Angela?
Very interesting. I agree. I think children are, they're incredible chameleons for one thing, because they have to be so many things to so many people. And I agree, they live in this world where when you're young, you don't have a whole lot of power. And they adjust better than most. I mean, they heal quicker than us, and they definitely adjust. And I believe the caller is right. I believe when you live in a world where you do have, you know, so little power, and everything has basically been made for adults, that you learn to survive and you take what's given. You know, and most kids do a very, you know, if they are around loving adults, you know, they do a very good job of, you know, manipulating, you know, the system and being able to jump over, you know, like Frank said, the large furniture,
yeah,
and be very comfortable.
Frank,
I agree.
Thanks for that call, Frank. I'm actually remiss here, Angela, because I started a story at the beginning of the program that I haven't finished, and this was the voted worst temper of the senior class at Winnemah.
Kind of scary, huh?
I love it. I just wonder how you turn, you know, how you explain the door slamming 14-year-old you transformed into the author that you are today?
Well, ultimately they come hand in hand. I was always just annihilated by social injustice, you know, dishonesty, social injustice. When I was 14, I was one of the angriest people in the world. Anything I saw as taking someone's rights from them, mm-hmm. Not telling the truth. I was just on it. So I was constantly angry. I mean, when you're in high school, you're in a school full of people finding their way. We were all a mess. You know, who isn't? You know, we were all a mess. But I just, you know, everything was hypocritical to me. You know, I had wonderful teachers, but, you know, when I wanted to talk about a certain thing and they were like, okay, we can only go so far with this, I thought that was hypocritical.
Right.
So I was an angry kid, which, you know, really helped in my writing, because, I mean, eventually,
You were writing at that time too, Angela?
I was writing at that time. Actually, I was writing angry punk poetry that the Literary Society would not put in their book at the end of the semester, because they said it was a bit angry and it was disturbing. And, of course, the Literary Society were, you know, my peers, and they found me very strange and very angry. And I think that's funny that I wasn't accepted into the Literary Society. I think that's kind of funny now.
What were you reading at the time, Angela?
You know, I was reading the Beat Poets. I actually had a former Beatnik English teacher, Valerie Varley. Are you out there, Mrs. Varley? She was incredible. So I was reading Kerouac and, you know, and there was Howl. I mean, and I was this little girl in northeastern Ohio in this little village of 3,500 people. I mean, wow.
Isn't it interesting the way you describe it now? Because I have this kind of image of the angry you with the razor blade necklace around your neck. That's going to follow you for the rest of your life.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
going to
follow
now.
Me. Yeah, my niece just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. She goes, you don't even wear jewelry now. I said, yeah, well, that was a statement.
But when I sketch in the picture of you as that angry 14-year-old, I automatically think of somebody who is angry at herself, at her parents, at her house, at her street. And what you're saying is that the anger really didn't have anything to do with that, but it had to do with bigger anger.
Absolutely. I mean, I loved my family. They were wonderful. My parents were typical 70s, very relaxed, very laid back. Nothing really upset them. You know, I'm sure we could have brought home, you know, wild beast and had them in the garage, and they would have gone, wow, just make sure you water them. You know, very laid back family. But again, at a very early age, I was just obsessed with, you know, social injustice, and everything seemed to anger me. You know, if someone was being mean to someone, I couldn't stand it. So, obviously, the hypersensitivity, I had to take it someplace. Otherwise, I would have, you know, been stomping around and, you know, just, you know, knocking cars over, I guess.
Are you still angry?
No, not as much. Strident. I can get a little...
Strident is good.
Strident is good. I can get a little politically vicious. I try not to do that too much. You know, I'm a generous person, I hope. But I've taken all that anger that I really didn't know what to do with, and found ways of, you know, becoming adult and dealing. And I hope. Some of my friends would say maybe at cocktail parties or in open events I might get a little bit too strident about some things, but the writing's chilled me out a bit.
Let's take another call from Amherst, New York. Kate's joining us now. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I was struck by the comment that people wouldn't be reading books because of the color of the children on the book, and it brought to mind the humorous poignant story, The Watsons Go to Birmingham.
Oh, perfect. They're wonderful.
It's a wonderful story, and it's great humor and interaction between siblings, but it's a time where this family is visiting Alabama during the bombings, and that book, which when my kids read books, I try to keep up with their reading. They read much more than I do, but...
Is this about a white family in Birmingham at the time, Kate? I'm sorry, I don't know the book.
It's the bombings, the church bombings, when the four girls were killed in,
okay,
in the church.
Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm. But it gave my children, who at the time were 9 and 11, an opportunity to talk about racism and civil rights, and it opened up discussions for us as a family, what was really going on. And as you know, Angela was saying, this social injustice, how could these children be victimized by it? And I think that if children don't have the opportunity to read books that have social dilemma in them and not an opportunity to talk about it, they are at a loss once they walk out your door. And
so get it in the books, Kate. That's what you're saying. Put it in the books.
Oh, absolutely. And not only put it in the books, put it in the classrooms, put it in the libraries. Our library here has book discussion groups. And kids from age 8 and up can read books and, meet every 3 Saturdays and really pull apart the plot and the characters and what was really going on. And I find that kids become more compassionate citizens as they progress through life. And that's really what I want to offer to our community.
Kate, thanks so much for calling. 1-800-423-8255 to join my conversation with Angela Johnson. Are you, mom, dad, prepared to read your child a story that tackles questions about divorce or death? What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. My guest this hour, Angela Johnson, children's book author, recently named winner of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. You may know of a couple of her books, both of them Coretta Scott King Award winners. Heaven, it's a teenage novel about a girl who learns that her mother and father are not her biological parents. The Other Side is a book of poetry that takes us back to the Alabama where Johnson was born. 1-800-423-8255 to bring you in next to... Philip, who's joining us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Philip.
Hi, good morning. How are y'all doing today?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Good.
I have been having a lot of thoughts lately as a parent of 2 boys and thinking about the loss of innocence. I guess we all experience, and I wanted to ask you guys about that because my own particular experience I remember that was so shocking and made me distrust adults for a while was... when I found out that Santa Claus didn't exist.
That's always a big one.
And the whole conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. Everybody lied to me about that. And to me, that was one of the most shocking things. It was a definite loss of innocence and probably one that didn't need to happen. But,
were you a grown-up when you found that out, Philip?
It was just last week. It's been awful. But to get back to my own children, there is a point that Bill Cosby made really eloquently when he published a children's book, I believe last year or sometime this year. And he talked about how in today's world that there's nothing that you parents really have lost a great deal of control over what their children learn when. And as a child's author and understanding children probably a lot more than I do, I'd be curious about your thoughts on that.
It's an interesting question, Angela. Go ahead.
It is an interesting question. I have friends who monitor their children's, you know, intake of television. They monitor their intake of radio and the music that they buy and even what they read. But there comes to be there's a certain time when, you know, your children are sent out to school, they're around other children, and there is only so much you can do. As my grandmother used to say, hope I have sent you some common sense, you know, when you, you know, walk out the door. But ultimately, I think you give them a moral compass, and of course we have our own moral compasses, and you teach them common sense, you teach them your values, you hope that their values are good ones, and you do lose control unless the children are homeschooled and are with you 24 hours a day. There's very little outside normal parenting and all of those wonderful things that when this child is born, you think you will give to them that you can do. And most of the times we're very lucky. And, you know, there are very few things that people learn that are going to be detrimental to them. They just have to discern and try to do the positive.
Okay,
I do believe that I think we get a little too hooked up on our kids getting information.
And,
you know,
and,
I think,
and in answer to Philip's question, though, I mean, and I don't want this to become an ask the doctor sort of session. But what do we do with the tooth fairy, though, if it's all about telling the truth to kids?
It's so hard. Actually, my niece's mother, this is an interesting story. We realized that we didn't know it at the time, though, that she was not raised with Santa Claus. You know, we didn't know it until she was 4 years old when we tried to introduce her to Santa Claus in a mall and she started screaming, you know, who is this man? You know, and then she went to school and a little boy told her that, you know, this man gives you presents. And all of a sudden, Santa Claus was okay with her. You know, myth is a wonderful thing with children. It's too bad that, you know, we have to tell them when they're 8 or 9, you know, this doesn't go on because we want to make them not get beaten up in school.
Yeah.
We want them not to be terrorized. But taking myth away is just, it's so heartbreaking. I mean, you know, if it's heartbreaking for children, the parents, you know, there's that loss of a little bit of that child that was born to them. And I understand what the caller is saying. All of a sudden, these people you know and you trust have betrayed you. So I think there is a place for myth. There is a place for fairy tales. Hey, there are some things I still believe in. I think we can balance it. You know, I think we can say, you know, maybe there's not a man who slides down the chimney and gets to every house in the world in a 24-hour period. But there are people on this planet who do good things. And guess what? There is a Santa Claus. You know, this guy in this town, you know, gives away toys.
Yeah.
But the loss of myth is very, very difficult.
1-800-423-8255. Thanks for that, Philip. To Karen, who's calling in from Boston. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Thank you. I would like to just to make some comments about my mom. I grew up in a conservative, wealthy town in Massachusetts, and my mom mothered 7 wonderful children and then lost her husband and then became a homosexual but didn't tell us about it. And so it left us sort of wondering, who is this other woman in the house and how do we respond to her? How do we, you know, where do we put her in our lives? And if I had known, it would have been so much saner, I think, and it really would have helped me to know, you know, how to trust people and how to, you know, anticipate the truth better. It's consequently made me quite a truth seeker and helped me to, you know, anticipate people's needs and read others' minds, so to speak. But I just wanted to let you know that I really appreciate your take on things, because I believe now I have a 6-year-old, and even though I don't, you know, share every gory detail of life, you know, we're open with him. We told him when the gorilla escaped from the zoo, you know, and we share things with him. And I just think that, you know, back then, you know, perhaps when my mom was young, it wasn't something they did. They didn't share feelings. They didn't talk about things. And now, you know, we've moved into a new time where that's a very important part of children's lives.
Would a book have made a difference, Karen, in your case? I mean, would that have been a gentle way to broach this?
Yeah, that's interesting.
It may have been. Perhaps, it wouldn't have been able to come home with me or something. I don't know. I mean,
I'm thinking of a book that your mother might have given you, you know, as a sort of way.
Oh, geez, a book would have helped. You know, if she...
Glad to hear it.
A book would have helped. I think, you know, just honesty in general helps, I think. Honesty, whether it's dark or light. I think, you know, shedding light in the darkness is a good thing. And if kids can, can have some, you know, participation with whatever is light or dark going on in the family. It's a healthy and beneficial thing.
Is this something you've written about, Angela? I'm not registering any of your books writing about gay parents.
Actually, I have a book coming up that has to do with a gay teenager, A Day in the Life, actually.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, there we go. So,
Karen, something for you to watch for.
Thanks, yeah, thanks definitely. For read on.
1-800-423-8255 to Zanny, who's calling in now from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Zanny.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm a writer, and I want to go back to the boys' issues. I have two boys. My boys are now 28 and 31. And when I was raising them, I'm talking about what kinds of books I've made available for them to read. Mm. I made all of the books on the same level for them to read. They read African-American books. They read books on every culture in the world. And when they grew up, they had a, you know, I'm very proud of them because they had a total significance of the people of the world. And and also the other thing that I think with African-American children, learning not only to read but to write. And that was another thing else, because I'm a writer, I guess that's why I emphasize that. But they learned to write.
Zanny, let me ask you a question. Earlier in the program, we were talking about where those books exist in the library or in the bookshop. Were you going to the African-American section for some books and then to the other section for other books? Should they be more together than they are now, for example?
Oh, definitely, because I write African-American books, and I have actually had bookstores. I have two books that have already gone out of print, and I have had a book where one bookstore took every book in the series except for my book because it was talking about Black Columbia. I mean,
amazing.
It had all the other Columbias except for the Black Columbia that I wrote, and I actually went in and asked them, why didn't they put my book in? It's the same series. And they said, well, we just choose not to. And here they're smack in the middle of the African-American community.
It's
a chain bookstore.
Yeah.
So, yes, what I do is let them loose. I let them just, like, I would go to Barnes & Noble and have my coffee and just let them go. And that's the way I raise them.
Good for
you. Think, and I was telling somebody the other day, we had a wonderful guest to come to Columbia. She's the founder of Children's Funds. And she wrote a book on boys. And one, my younger son, I never really got him to read like the older son. And he took this book, and I can't even remember the name because he never gave it back to me. It's about boys. I know it was about Black boys. She wrote about Black boys, but you know, you never know. You never know when they'll get interested in something. So that's what I that's what I strive for. That I don't make it a black white book. There are books out there.
I'm listening to what Zanny's saying, Angela, and it's like the whole idea of putting the books in the hands of kids that like and they'll read them.
Exactly. But again, it's the moral judgments of adults that aren't getting these books in the hands of children. I mean, ultimately, you know, the woman at the book conference saying, oh, she didn't think that was, you know, these children would understand these books. It's the idea that the bookstores are saying, well, what you're not able to walk around the bookstore. We have to lead you to the African-American section. I mean, ultimately, children are being denied work by, you know, writers from different cultural and ethnic backgrounds because some adult person has made up their mind about something they grew up with 30, 40 years ago and their idea about how you categorize literature. And it's hurtful. It's very hurtful.
Let's see if you know, can squeak in one more call here. Let's go to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Stephanie's joining us now. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. I wanted to ask the author if she's thought about any issues that she wouldn't talk about in her books, such as rape or incest, things that, of course, a lot of, unfortunately, young children experience in these days. Are there things that you wouldn't discuss in your books?
There are absolutely no taboo subjects as far as I'm concerned. Absolutely. Every day, you know, every minute in this country, you know, a child is raped, families dysfunctional, completely out of control lives are spread in the newspaper. And it's not necessarily done in a sympathetic way. You know, it's the horror of the week or, you know, it's the 6 o'clock news. And no, I think nothing is taboo as long as, I mean, these are universal themes. This isn't something, you know, that happens once in a while. This is ongoing. And I definitely, most definitely would not hesitate to write about these things.
Stephanie, would you buy a book for a daughter that you knew was about domestic violence or incest?
I think I absolutely would, especially with issues such as rape, when children may not always be telling their parents what's going on. And so if they go to the library and they see a book that can help them sort of self-heal without necessarily having to reach out to an adult, and maybe that book could help them understand how they could talk to people about it, because I have a sister who experienced it, and she wasn't able to talk about it until she was well into her 20s. So, you know, who knows what a book like that might have, how it could have impacted her.
And Angela, you can do this. You believe, Angela, you can do this with stories, not with the sort of self-help tone, right?
I can definitely do it with stories. That's, you know, I'm always surprised when I see one of my books under social studies, or I had a book about kids moving away and they put it under sort of self-help, which really made me laugh. And I thought, okay, then if this helps some kid who's going through a difficult time about leaving, you know, that works. But, you know, if I can do it poetically, if I can do it sensitively, if it can, and of course I don't write self-help, I think this is a good thing. I don't think you have to preach to children. I don't think there has to be a 1-800 number in the back of my book. But I mean, at some point there might be, if, you know, I'm really discussing issues of, you know, incest and rape. But ultimately, if a kid opens up this book and in some way comforts them, changes their life in some way, makes them a happier person, or even just informs, that's enough for me.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for your call.
And thank you, Stephanie.
Quick last one for you, Angela. It's this grant supposed to say, you know, we've decided you're very good at what you do, and it's supposed to give you time and space to do more, but that's a bit of a challenge for you. It's like, you're good, but you can do more.
You can do a whole lot more. A little pressure, that, isn't it? But I'm a workaholic at heart, so it gives me the freedom to keep on keeping on.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Angela Johnson, author of many children's books, including most recently The First Part Last, A Cool Moonlight, I Dream of Trains. Why do I have so much trouble saying that? I Dream of Trains. She's just been named one of this year's MacArthur Fellows. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.